She had never believed that there were men with whom a certain method, which she had never used, would work. Such men were not hired by Taggart Transcontinental, and she had never been forced to deal with them before. "Do you know who I am?" she asked, in the cold, overbearing tone of a personal threat. It worked.
I guess so, he answered.
"Then let me tell you that if you don't send a crew to me at once, you'll be out of a job within 1 hour after I reach Bradshaw, which I'll reach sooner or later. You'd better make it sooner."
"Yes, ma'am," he said.
"Call out a full passenger train crew and give them orders to run us to Laurel, where we have our own men."
"Yes, ma'am," he added. "Will you tell headquarters that it was you who told me to do it?"
"I will."
"And that it's you who's responsible for it?"
"I am." There was a pause. Then he asked helplessly,
"Now, how am I going to call the men? Most of them haven't got any phones."
"Do you have a call boy?"
"Yes, but he won't get here till morning."
"Is there anybody in the yards right now?"
"There's the wiper in the roundhouse."
"Send him out to call the men."
"Yes, ma'am." "Hold the line."
She leaned against the side of the phone box to wait. Kellogg was smiling.
"And you propose to run a railroad? A transcontinental railroad? With that?" he asked.
She shrugged. She could not keep her eyes off the beacon. It seemed so close, so easily within her reach. She felt as if the unconfessed thought were struggling furiously against her, splattering bits of the struggle all over her mind. A man able to harness an untapped source of energy. A man working on a motor to make all other motors useless. She could be talking to him, to his kind of brain, in a few hours. In just a few hours. What if there was no need to hurry to him? It was what she wanted to do. It was all she wanted. Her work? What was her work? To move on to the fullest, most exacting use of her mind. Or to spend the rest of her life doing his thinking for a man unfit to be a night dispatcher? Why had she chosen to work? Was it in order to remain where she had started, night operator of Rockdale Station? No, lower than that. She had been better than that dispatcher even at Rockdale. Was this to be the final sum, an end, lower than her beginning? There was no reason to hurry. She was the reason. They needed the trains, but they did not need the motor. She needed the motor. Her duty? To whom? The dispatcher was gone for a long time. When he came back, his voice sounded sulky.
"Well, the wiper says he can get the men all right, but it's no use, because how am I going to send them out to you? We have no engine."
"No engine?"
"No. The superintendent took one to run down to Laurel, and the other's in the shop's been there for weeks, and the switch engine jumped rail this morning. They'll be working on her till tomorrow afternoon."
"What about the wrecker's engine that you were offering to send us?"
"Oh, she's up north. They had a wreck there yesterday. She hasn't come back yet."
"Have you a diesel car?"
"Never had any such thing, not around here."
"Have you a track motor car?"
"Yes, we have that."
"Send them out on the track motor car."
"Oh. Yes, ma'am."
"Tell your men to stop here at track phone number 83 to pick up Mr. Kellogg and myself." She was looking at the beacon.
"Yes, ma'am."
"Call the Taggart trainmaster at Laurel. Report the Comet's delay and explain to him what happened." She put her hand into her pocket and suddenly clutched her fingers. She felt the package of cigarettes. "Say," she asked, "what's that beacon about half a mile from here?"
"From where you are? Oh, that must be the emergency landing field of the flagship airlines."
"I see. Well, that's all. Get your men started at once. Tell them to pick up Mr. Kellogg by track phone number 83.
"Yes, ma'am."
She hung up. Kellogg was grinning.
"An airfield, isn't it?" he asked.
"Yes." She stood looking at the beacon, her hand still clutching the cigarettes in her pocket.
"So they're going to pick up Mr. Kellogg, are they?"
She whirled to him, realizing what decision her mind had been reaching without her conscious knowledge. "No," she said. "No, I didn't mean to abandon you here. It's only that I, too, have a crucial purpose out west where I ought to hurry. So I was thinking of trying to catch a plane."
but I can't do it, and it's not necessary.
Come on, he said, starting in the direction of the airfield.
But I...
If there's anything you want to do more urgently than to nurse those morons, go right ahead.
More urgently than anything in the world, she whispered.
I'll undertake to remain in charge for you and to deliver the comet to your man at Laurel.
Thank you. But if you're hoping... I'm not deserting, you know.
I know.
Then why are you so eager to help me?
I just want you to see what it's like to do something you want for once.
There's not much chance that they'll have a plane at that field.
There's a good chance that they will. There were two planes on the edge of the airfield. One, the half-charred remnant of a wreck, not worth salvaging for scrap. The other, a Dwight Sanders monoplane, brand new, the kind of ship that men were pleading for in vain all over the country. There was one sleepy attendant at the airfield, young, pudgy, and but for a faint smell of college about his vocabulary, a brain brother of the night dispatcher of Bradshaw. He knew nothing about the two planes. They had been there when he first took this job a year ago. He had never inquired about them, and neither had anybody else. In whatever silent crumbling had gone on at the distant headquarters, in the slow dissolution of a great airline company, the Sanders monoplane had been forgotten, as assets of this nature were being forgotten everywhere, as the model of the motor had been forgotten on a junk pile, and left in plain sight, had conveyed nothing to the inheritors and the takers over. There were no rules to tell the young attendant whether he was expected to keep the Sanders plane or not. The decision was made for him by the brusque, confident manner of the two strangers, by the credentials of Miss Dagny Taggart, vice president of a railroad, by brief hints about a secret emergency mission, which sounded like Washington to him, by the mention of an agreement with the airline's top officials in New York, whose names he had never heard before, by a check for $15,000, written by Miss Taggart as deposit against the return of the Sanders plane, and by another check for $200 for his own personal courtesy. He fueled the plane. He checked it as best he could. He found a map of the country's airports, and she saw that a landing field on the outskirts of Afton, Utah, was marked as still in existence. She had been too tensely, swiftly active to feel anything, but at the last moment, when the attendant switched on the floodlights, when she was about to climb aboard, she paused to glance at the emptiness of the sky, then at Owen Kellogg. He stood alone in the white glare, his feet planted firmly apart, on an island of cement in a ring of blinding lights, with nothing beyond the ring but an irredeemable night, and she wondered which one of them was taking the greater chance and facing the more desolate emptiness. "In case anything happens to me," she said, "will you tell Eddie Willers in my office to give Jeff Allen a job, as I promised?" "I will. Is this all you wish to be done in case anything happens?"
She considered it and smiled sadly, in astonishment at the realization. "Yes, I guess that's all. Except tell Hank Reardon what happened, and that I asked you to tell him."
"I will."
She lifted her head and said firmly, "I don't expect it to happen, however. When you reach Laurel, call Winston, Colorado, and tell them that I will be there tomorrow by noon."
"Yes, Miss Taggart."
She wanted to extend her hand in parting, but it seemed inadequate, and then she remembered what he had said about times of loneliness. She took out the package and silently offered him one of his own cigarettes. His smile was a full statement of understanding, and the small flame of his match, lighting their two cigarettes, was their most enduring handshake. Then she climbed aboard, and the next span of her consciousness was not separate moments and movements, but the sweep of a single motion and a single unit of time, a progression forming one entity, like the notes of a piece of music, from the touch of her hand on the starter to the blast of the motor sound that broke off like a mountain rock slide, all contact with the time behind her, to the circling fall of a blade that vanished in a fragile sparkle of whirling air that cut the space ahead, to the start for the runway, to the brief pause, then to the forward thrust, to the long perilous run, the run not to be obstructed, the straight line run that gathers power by spending it on a harder and harder and ever-accelerating effort, the straight line to a purpose, to the moment, unnoticed, when the earth drops off and the line, unbroken, goes on into space in the simple, natural act of rising. She saw the telegraph wires of the trackside slipping past at the tip of her toes. The earth was falling downward, and she felt as if its weight were dropping off her ankles, as if the globe would go shrinking to the size of a ball, a convict's ball she had dragged and lost. Her body swayed, drunk with the shock of a discovery, and her craft rocked with her body, and it was the earth below that reeled with the rocking of her craft, the discovery that her life was now in her own hands, that there was no necessity to argue, to explain, to teach, to plead, to fight, nothing but to see and think and act. Then the earth steadied into a wide sheet that grew wider and wider as she circled, rising. When she glanced down for the last time, the lights of the field were extinguished. There was only the single beacon left, and it looked like the tip of Kellogg's cigarette, glowing as a last salute in the darkness. Then she was left with the lights on her instrument panel and the spread of stars beyond her film of glass. There was nothing to support her but the beat of the engine and the minds of the men who had made the plane. But what else supports one anywhere, she thought. The line of her course went northwest to cut a diagonal across the state of Colorado. She knew she had chosen the most dangerous route, over too long a stretch of the worst mountain barrier. But it was the shortest line, and safety lay in altitude, and no mountains seemed dangerous compared to the dispatcher of Bradshaw. The stars were like foam, and the sky seemed full of flowing motion, the motion of bubbles settling and forming, the floating of circular waves without progression. A spark of light flared up on Earth once in a while, and it seemed brighter than all the static blue above. But it hung alone, between the black of ashes and the blue of a crypt. It seemed to fight for its fragile foothold. It greeted her and went. The pale streak of a river came rising slowly from the void, and for a long stretch of time it remained in sight, gliding imperceptibly to meet her. It looked like a phosphorescent vein showing through the skin of the earth, a delicate vein without blood. When she saw the lights of a town like a handful of gold coins flung upon the prairie, the brightly violent lights fed by an electric current, they seemed as distant as the stars, and now as unattainable. The energy that had lighted them was gone. The power that created power stations in empty prairies had vanished, and she knew of no journey to recapture it. Yet these had been her stars, she thought, looking down. These had been her goal, her beacon, the aspiration drawing her upon her upward course. That which others claimed to feel at the sight of the stars, stars safely distant by millions of years, and thus imposing no obligation to act, but serving as the tinsel of futility, she had felt at the sight of electric bulbs lighting the streets of a town. It was this earth below that had been the height she had wanted to reach. And she wondered how she had come to lose it. Who had made of it a convict's ball to drag through muck? Who had turned its promise of greatness into a vision never to be reached? But the town was past, and she had to look ahead to the mountains of Colorado rising in her way. The small glass dial on her panel showed that she was now climbing. The sound of the engine beating through the metal shell around her, trembling in the wheel against her palms, like the pounding of a heart strained to a solemn effort, told her of the power carrying her above the peaks. The earth was now a crumpled sculpture that swayed from side to side, the shape of an explosion still shooting sudden spurts to reach the plain. She saw them as dented black cuts, ripping through the milky spread of stars, straight in her path and tearing wider. Her mind one with her body, and her body one with the plane, she fought the invisible suction drawing her downward. She fought the sudden gusts that tipped the earth, as if she were about to roll off into the sky, with half of the mountains rolling after. It was like fighting a frozen ocean, where the touch of a single spray would be fatal. There were stretches of rest when the mountains shrank down, over valleys filled with fog. Then the fog rose higher to swallow the earth, and she was left suspended in space, left motionless but for the sound of the engine. But she did not need to see the earth. The instrument panel was now her power of sight. It was the condensed sight of the best minds able to guide her on her way. Their condensed sight, she thought, offered to hers,
and requiring only that she be able to read it. How had they been paid for it, they, the sight-givers? From condensed milk to condensed music to the condensed sight of precision instruments. What wealth had they not given to the world, and what had they received in return? Where were they now? Where was Dwight Sanders? Where was the inventor of her motor? The fog was lifting, and in a sudden clearing she saw a drop of fire on a spread of rock. It was not an electric light. It was a lonely flame in the darkness of the earth. She knew where she was, and she knew that flame. It was Wyatt's torch. She was coming close to her goal. Somewhere behind her in the northeast stood the summits pierced by the Taggart Tunnel. The mountains were sliding in a long descent into the steadier soil of Utah. She let her plane slip closer to the earth. The stars were vanishing. The sky was growing darker. But in the bank of clouds to the east, thin cracks were beginning to appear, first as threads, then faint spots of reflection, then straight bands that were not yet pink, but no longer blue, the color of a future light, the first hints of the coming sunrise. They kept appearing and vanishing, slowly growing clearer, leaving the sky darker, then breaking it wider apart like a promise struggling to be fulfilled. She heard a piece of music beating in her mind, one she seldom liked to recall. Not Halley's fifth concerto, but his fourth. The cry of a tortured struggle, with the chords of its theme breaking through like a distant vision to be reached.